step out of a garage door in the Northland and into the suburban Kansas City dream. Living on a cul-de-sac means you are often struck by the sound of quiet. You can sometimes hear kids playing or the sound of birds and planes flying overhead, but hardly any traffic. And if you take off in one of those planes and look down on our city, you'll see that the suburbs are mazes of cul-de-sacs filled with curlicue-shaped dead ends. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll look at where cul-de-sacs came from, why we built them, and how they continue to shape the communities we live in today. Let's start with some national perspective, and then we'll get local. My first guest this morning is Ellen Dunham Jones, who joins us from the School of Architecture at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Great to meet you, Gina.
Great to meet you, too. If you had to tell the story of the cul-de-sac in America in just a few sentences, how would you summarize it?
I would say that they evolved at the exact same time, really, as we started driving cars. And they were, from the get-go, a reaction against all of the safety concerns that cars suddenly added, that streets became seen as really deadly places for pedestrians, especially for children. So the movement away from those overcrowded, dirty streets full of cars, there were no laws early on when the cars came in along. The cars really were killing people at pretty high rates. So both the move to suburbanize and especially the move to build cul-de-sacs that didn't have as much through traffic really was a response in the 1920s, the 1920s, and then it really caught on when we started suburbanizing at a massive scale post-World War II.
What do you think was going on behind the more suburban model of cul-de-sac? I mean, you talked about traffic with sort of a reaction to city streets in the early days of the car, but I feel like there's more to it, more of a lifestyle desire once you talk about the suburbs.
There's certainly also a notion that there's more a sense of greater social cohesion, that one knows one's neighbors, the kids all play together, in the cul-de-sac. And there's certainly some truth in that. One of the early models, 1928 in New Jersey, Radburn was a garden city development, importing all the newest, latest modern ideas about how to have houses that actually backed onto the cul-de-sac, but then fronted onto long linear parks. So that, and that was the communal space where everybody gathered and played together, both adults and children, but that also then the children could walk to school without ever crossing a street. And so the both the safety side, but also certainly that kind of community, the idea of a community, especially of families with young children, was always part of that early appeal.
The term cul-de-sac is interesting to me. We've chosen to name what I think of as a very American design feature with a French turn of phrase, which happens to mean bottom of the bag. So you know when you put stuff in a sack, it kind of bulges on the bottom. That's what cul-de-sacs are named after. Why on earth did anyone think this would be an alluring metaphor? I mean, first of all, do you think of this as a very American thing?
It certainly was popularized in the States. Post-war, it becomes absolutely a signature American. But in fact, it actually goes back more to English, early cottage courts. Very early garden city planning ideas were actually much more coming from England. And I don't know exactly, why we went with the French name cul-de-sac, but, it does have more marketing appeal than dead end, which would be the other term that is used for these streets.
Critiquing the cul-de-sac is something we'll definitely be getting into, but I don't want to jump into that too fast without taking it pretty seriously that this idea came from a perceived need that a lot of people felt and had to be on board with, or the cul-de-sac wouldn't have ever taken off. So, is there anything that you feel like people were really after when they started building cul-de-sacs like crazy that we haven't touched on, or is there any more context that you want to offer for that?
Well, the history, safety really is the number one driver. I mean, we get to the point where our government was actually recommending that instead of building gridded street networks, which had been the historical pattern for thousands of years of how we build cities, the recommendations were to build much more cul-de-sac neighborhoods to minimize cut-through traffic and to separate residential living from the sort of downtown commercial area or and certainly the manufacturing areas. So it historically, safety was absolutely the driver. I think what happened then by the post-war suburbs, though, is you start to see developers. Now they're making the houses front onto the cul-de-sacs, and they're not putting in that communal linear park that I described at Radburn. And it becomes much more about the sort of what we all know now as the standard image of the American dream of every house has its own private property, with minimum cut-through traffic. But it lost that early on, there really was that emphasis on public space that everyone used together.
That's really interesting. Ellen Dunham Jones, stay with me, okay?
Absolutely.
We'll hear more from Ellen in a little bit when we hear about some of the new thinking on cul-de-sacs, including efforts to remove them in some parts of the country. But let's get some local perspective first. I'm joined now by Daniel Serta, Central Standard's go-to guy for all things urban design. He's with us from Insight. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well.
We're also joined by Kristen Jeffers. She's new to Kansas City and she blogs about her observations as the Black Urbanist. Kristen works for Bike Walk KC. Hey there, Kristen.
Hey.
So, Daniel, we've heard the national history of cul-de-sacs, their origin story, if you will. What's the history of cul-de-sacs in Kansas City? Where were the first ones and when were they built?
Well, the formal history, I think, in Kansas City, you could trace back to some early private residential streets. There are great examples of this in cities like Boston and Philadelphia, St. Louis, more locally. But probably the best example locally is Janssen Place in Old Hyde Park.
Oh, with those giant houses and.
So if you look at Janssen Place, it's not a cul-de-sac in the figural sense that we're talking about here today, but it is a private street. It's essentially a loop street. There's one entry point, one exit point, the same colonnaded gate that you go through. And the idea was to create essentially a very pristine, clearly demarcated private residential environment that only the very affluent people that lived along the street were allowed essentially to enter into.
When was this?
This would have been in the 1880s. And it's still there. And it's undergone an interesting evolution in that many of the older homes, some of them have been replaced. It's gone through different phases of change. But it is still, really, it distinguished itself, because of the fact that it's essentially this almost guarded street. And so that's the more austere example, I guess I would say, in the early historical reference. There are other examples you find. J.C. Nichols was paramount nationally as well as in Kansas City. But if you look at the early subdivision design that J.C. Nichols was creating, it's very much in line with what Ellen Dunham Jones was talking about in terms of the period. We're talking the early 1920s. It was very much in line with those considerations about safety, but it was even probably more so. A figure, kind of a trademark of Nichols' approach in terms of talking about comfort and privacy and security and almost sort of the sanctity of residential environments. Nichols was very, very much a proponent nationally of the idea of taking residences out of the busy business districts of cities and putting them in a separate place. And if you think about where the Country Club District was originally developed, the Country Club area, the Country Club which is now the site of Luce Park, was originally built in the countryside. It was outside the city limits. When Nichols started building there, it was still largely on the edge of the city limits. The city had largely developed to the east. There were people that called that area Nichols Folly because they thought that no one would ever want to live to the south, and he obviously proved them wrong. But if you look at what he did in terms of creating a variety of subdivisions, and this stretches, you know, for the better part of about 50 years with the various subdivisions that the Nichols Company built into the Kansas suburbs, there's a very high emphasis on eliminating through traffic, on creating very curvilinear grids of streets, and on essentially creating a very almost semi-private road network. They're public streets, but they're really essentially to be navigated only by people that live immediately on them.
Daniel, you mentioned privacy and sort of the sanctity of the private residence in the 1920s. And I'm curious about whether there was something in particular about the 1920s in Kansas City or elsewhere that made this such a preoccupation.
Well, I think there were a variety of things going on. You have to remember the 20s was a boom era. It was an era of a lot of affluence. There were a lot of people that were buying and building homes. That was an entirely different context, however, than, say, you know, the post-war boom. It was still a period in which it was very difficult to finance the construction of a home. It was very difficult to obtain a residential mortgage. So homeownership was still largely the province of the upper middle class. That changed after the world, after World War II, and that's why you see, you know, kind of the mass explosion across the geography of these kinds of developments. But that's a big part of the story. It was a boom period during the 20s. There were a lot of people that were building and buying homes. And I think something else that was probably going on at the time, you know, it was one of the first periods of a lot of unsettling change. Remember, this is after World War I. There were a variety of, you know, social tensions in the air. There was a certain level of discomfort about, you know, immigration into the United States. There were laws that were put in place that, you know, excluded, for example, Eastern European immigrants and created restrictions. I think there was just very active thinking, both in public conversation and a lot of private development circles, about the notion of an ideal community.
Or, and, like, that what's out there might be scary, and so we have to protect what's in here.
Ellen Dunham Jones referenced this earlier, because there was very active thought back then about the idea of, I guess what we would call homogeneity. You know, the idea that an optimal neighborhood, an optimal community is largely comprised of people that are very similar to each other. They're similar to each other racially. This is a period when racial exclusion was very widely practiced and very much put into place in terms of private market activities, what we call de facto segregation. This is also a period where there were a lot of class-based distinctions being made, you know, between sort of the elite neighborhoods. If you look at an earlier period, there was, you know, late 19th, early 20th century, it was much more apt that you have very, you know, high-end residential districts, but they tended to be compact, a little more scattered, and a little more interspersed, and not necessarily very far away from areas where lower-income people and ethnic minorities and immigrants and others lived.
When you look at Kansas City and its suburbs today, what would you say is the role of cul-de-sacs in shaping the big picture of how we live and work and move through this city that we call home?
I really think there's two sides to it. A big part of it is the private community side that you've already referred to. From a practical standpoint, I think it's something that people don't self-consciously step out and think about this much. And it is one of the challenges that a lot of urban designers are thinking about with cul-de-sacs. The reality of life in a cul-de-sac is, yes, traffic, there's statistics that bear this out. Cul-de-sacs tend to be safer. Speeds are lower there. They have lower volumes of traffic because they're largely intended to get the people that live on the cul-de-sac to and from home. But the issue is cul-de-sacs sit within a context of a larger hierarchy of streets that we've developed. There are technical classifications for streets that kind of grew up around the same time that cul-de-sacs were being promoted by real estate developers. And the reality is, if you live in a suburb on a cul-de-sac, you essentially have to drive anywhere to get anywhere, to do almost anything. I mean, if you want to take a short trip to a store that might be 4 or 5 blocks away, you pretty much have to get in your car because there's not a direct pathway to walk there. And those are the kinds of challenges that urban designers are looking at very actively right now in terms of thinking about, you know, how potentially might we retrofit these things? There are some real challenges with doing that. What are some ways that we might take some of the earlier insights and thoughts about you know, not only accommodating automobiles and helping people, particularly children, stay safe from automobiles, but also to go back to some of that more Radburn-like thinking about also accommodating pedestrians and thinking about walkability in neighborhoods.
Kristen, how do you see cul-de-sacs fitting into the way Kansasians live and move throughout their city?
I definitely see it up on the Northland end. I'm still in the process of sort of choosing where I shop because, you know, the one benefit of, in a way, of the cul-de-sac era in the suburban area is that a lot of the major stores cluster around these areas. And even, say, sort of the newer sets, you know, around the airport in the Northland, I look over when I'm at that Target and I see this neighborhood and I see the houses sort of facing each other. They're on their own plot. And I do feel like it's still a legacy of, and I guess in that area, maybe the farmlands being sold off and the plots there, and it's easy to just cram houses on a smaller plot, and the cul-de-sac enables developers to build tightly. But does it really enable people to walk across their backyards, down the hill, up the other hill to go to all these resources? I mean, literally, outside of some of these folks' back windows, they can see things that walking to isn't that convenient.
Yeah, so it's sort of like a barrier that keeps you from something very nearby.
Yes.
Well, today it's kind of popular to diss the cul-de-sac, and I'm first of all sort of curious for insights into what's behind that and what are sort of the primary arguments against the cul-de-sac lifestyle. I'll start with you, Daniel.
Sure. Well, I think generally there's been a certain degree of sort of disaffection with suburbs and with suburban life. I find it hard to think about the sort of return to the city because I know so many younger people, former students of mine, for example, that have moved to the city. And overwhelmingly, it seems most of them grew up in the suburbs. And there was a certain sense of dissatisfaction with the environment and the lifestyle and the pace and looking for more interest and more diversity and more activity and that sort of thing. So I think there's been sort of a lifestyle shift in the last decade or two. The return to the city movement, I think there's been a certain degree of looking down the nose, I think, at suburban environments in particular. But there's also been a lot of very proactive thought about some of the challenges that are posed, particularly to issues like walkability. We have really significant challenges throughout the United States with public health. And there's more and more evidence all the time that a lot of that has to do with our lifestyle choices, the fact that we live very sedentary lifestyles, but that we don't participate in what you almost might call passive activity, you know, getting up and walking to the store and that sort of thing. Because from a practical standpoint, most people live in environments where that's, as Kristen was saying, it's very impractical to do that.
Kristen, since you work for Bike Walk KC and you're sort of focused on transit options, I want to share with you that as someone who lives in the city and often gets lost in the suburbs, I get the feeling, and maybe it's just paranoia, that that's actually a significant part of the function that cul-de-sacs serve. People who live in a neighborhood know which streets lead out onto a cross street and which ones don't. So outsiders can get kind of trapped and disoriented, unlike on a grid where anyone with a basic grasp of how to count can get themselves oriented. Are communities with cul-de-sacs, do you think that they're designed to thwart outsiders?
Absolutely. You know, I definitely have spent my time in a cul-de-sac. I grew up on one. And, you know, I talked with my mom and their neighbors, and they like the fact that they know who's coming in and out. But, you know, there's a concern that, you know, what if you do need to get out? You know, I've seen emergency vehicles come down that street, but what if it gets stuck? The way it's built, and this is a suburb back east of North Carolina, but essentially we're still dealing with a lot of the same terrain, hills, floodplain, occasionally. You know, what if you are stuck in your house? You know, what if it floods? And, you know, this is a big circle that pulls together. You know, you kind of have to think about that. You have to think about the fact that you're going to probably age in place, and you probably want to age in place. What will happen with that? You know, my grandmother lives on an actual dead end in a rural area in North Carolina. Again, do you want to age in place, and do you want to make sure that people can get in and out to find you versus thinking that people are going to come in? Another thing is, I feel like, you know, not everybody knows where your street is. Granted, Google has enabled the fact that people can Google certain street names and see where things are, but not a lot of people still have that good geospatial context of this street is here, this street is shaped like this, this connects to this. And so, honestly, you know, if a person is on your street, you know, you might want to ask if they are do belong to somebody else. It might be an older teenage grandkid, or, you know, a visiting relative, or somebody new who might have something to offer on the street versus, oh no, they're from in from the outside. How do they find us? I thought I picked the most obscure street in Kansas City or America.
Yeah. Ellen Dunham Jones, I wonder from your perspective if our ideas of what constitutes safety have changed. I mean, if that's part of the sort of fading of the cul-de-sac from, like, what's really popular in urban design.
Absolutely. I think there are several topics to get into on this. I mean, we've basically found out there's all sorts of unintended consequences. So early on, the cul-de-sac, yes, it does reduce the amount of traffic on that particular little bit of dead-end street. But in fact, it also increases traffic throughout the whole rest of the network because every trip now has to be made by car. So there are studies.
And on a major thoroughfare.
Absolutely. So there are studies. We end up with a system that now has underused local streets and incredibly congested, overused arterials. Just as Daniel was pointing out, we sort of, you know, we have this hierarchy of streets. So you end up with all the traffic funneled onto extremely unsafe streets. And so there are studies in California of communities that were built sort of before the cul-de-sacs with more of a grid, and looking at region-wide statistics, and there's actually much higher crash rates, much higher, people are driving much more in communities that are characterized by a lot of cul-de-sacs. So you end up with sort of some local benefits, but metro-wide burdens as a result of the cul-de-sacs, and also higher costs. So part of what has been really changing is recognition on the part of the municipalities that they really can't afford to the costs of repaving and you know, maintaining cul-de-sacs that are at fairly low densities, that those streets that don't really contribute to the efficiency of the overall street network is becoming another aspect that, you know, suddenly it gets into safety, because then can the emergency vehicles, the fire engines and all the fire trucks really afford, you need more fire stations in a cul-de-sac area because of just the mileage that a truck would have to go.
Wow.
You know, it affords, it's you can have way less municipal costs when you have more compact, more connected. And then the on the safety, one of the other, there's a couple of other issues. I mean, one that's really a sad one. In Virginia, there's a professor at University of Virginia, Bill Lucy, did a study and found that while it's rare, what he found was that children growing up on cul-de-sacs learn that it's safe to play in the street, and sadly are less aware of getting out of the way of traffic. So backovers, where a car backs over a child as it's pulling out of the driveway, they're rare, but they have only happened on cul-de-sacs.
Wow.
So you get some real, you know, and that's sort of one of the more just immediate, you know, I know really kind of makes your heart stand still. But just reinforcing Daniel's point that, you know, the sedentary lifestyles associated with the kind of suburban living where you just don't walk, you drive everywhere, is really now the number one health threat for us are these chronic diseases of obesity and the heart disease and diabetes that comes from that. The early, you know, cars have become safer. We are still under 35. Car crashes are still the number eight cause of death for under age 35. And we often sort of don't look at that.
We just accept it. It sounds like our ideas of where threats come from and what threatens our safety have changed really dramatically. And with that, our ideas of the value of the cul-de-sac have also changed dramatically. And now there's such a shift in thinking toward viewing this as a really problematic design feature when overused in cities. But Daniel, the reality is a lot of people do still live on cul-de-sacs, and I don't Absolutely. Think they're all just dying to find a house on a through street. Maybe some of them, but Sure. not all of them. Does this point to a disconnect between what we want in theory versus how we're truly comfortable living our lives, or something else?
Well, at the base level, it's a reflection of the fact that housing markets are what economists would call very inelastic. In other words, they're very, you know, housing as a fixed asset on a piece of land. You can't simply scrub the plot clean and change it every couple of years the way you redecorate your living room. You know, it's a fixed asset. We typically buy a house on a 30-year mortgage. You're expected to have it for a while. And those arrangements are relatively fixed. They don't change very quickly. And that's part of the challenge. I mean, for example, you go back to the Radburn model, where there was an active provision of pedestrian walking spaces. And as Ellen pointed out, the orientation of the homes was away from the street, not toward the cul-de-sac. If you wanted to come into a standard subdivision and sort of stamp that model onto the configuration, you hit a basic challenge, which is all of that land is privately owned. And at bare minimum, you would have to have what's called an easement, which is essentially legal authority to tread upon someone else's property to do that. And as you can imagine, that immediately provokes reactions from neighbors who don't want to have strangers necessarily walking through and past their yards.
Call 816-235-2888 if you live or have lived on a cul-de-sac. Tell us your story. Did you love it, hate it, something in between? What are we missing from your perspective? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about cul-de-sacs, streets that end in little loop-de-loos instead of letting out onto a major thoroughfare on both sides. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what life on the cul-de-sac is like for you. While you're doing that, let's hear a little clip from the design podcast 99% Invisible. The show's producer, Katie Mingle, confesses that she's embarrassed about having grown up on a cul-de-sac. After doing a bunch of research that only fuels her existing contempt, Katie calls her mom with an important question and talks with host Roman Mars about the answer.
I guess I'm wondering how you could move our family to such a depraved place.
We loved the cul-de-sac because it was a place where, you know, you were allowed to go out there all hours of the day and night and play and be pretty much unsupervised.
Oh, she sounds nice.
She's the nicest, and it's true. I did love the cul-de-sac. I didn't like school, and I didn't fit in there, but none of that seemed to matter on the cul-de-sac. On the cul-de-sac, it was all about ghost in the graveyard and finding the guts to launch off the skateboard ramp. And that was a world I shined in. My parents, though, they always seemed like they lived there just for me. And after I moved away, eventually they did too. Now my mom and dad live in a new development that urban planners would refer to as mixed use. That's shops and houses and restaurants all mixed in together. They love it. They live right above the Gap. There's a library within walking distance. My dad helps lead a lecture series in their condo. And I like that as they get older, they won't need to be dependent on a car to get what they need. It's perfect for them. But for a kid?
Where do the kids play?
Where do they play?
Yeah.
The one family that I'm thinking of who live up on the fifth floor, their children are pretty young, and they have talked about they go to different parks around the area quite often.
Let's hear what our guests have to say about this exchange, because there's so much in it, from who cul-de-sacs are really built for to what the other model is and what it might be missing for some people, conversely. So I'm joined by Ellen Dunham-Jones from Georgia Tech and local urban designers Daniel Serta and Kristen Jeffers. You know, Kristen, what do you think about this idea that maybe different age groups are served differently by various urban design models, say a cul-de-sac on the one hand and a mixed-use neighborhood on the other?
I can definitely see that. You know, I'm hearing the exchange between mom and daughter, and I feel like it's the same thing that my mom and I would say, especially. But the key difference with me and my mom is my mom loves gardening. She loves the fact that she has her own plot of land, and we don't live in a suburban area. We actually live incorporated inside the city, so they don't regulate how much land that you can garden on in your yard. So she could, you know, in theory, go outside and put flowers in the ground. She can grow her own vegetables. Same thing with my grandmother. She, you know, we have acres of land. So again, vegetable gardens. So there's a degree to which, you know, people can go back to nature in their own space. And there's a comfort in that. I think the struggle comes from at any age. You know, we're not paying attention. You know, what Ellen said about the kids who don't learn to look both ways, even in the safe street that they've created. Even if we're talking about, you know, a complete street, you still have to make sure someone's not jumping the lines. So, again, there are benefits for both. But I think the key issue with the cul-de-sac mindset is that we spend too much time trying to keep people out, and we see it as a means of exclusion. We need to be open to the fact that this is a safe space and a great space for everyone, but we do need to be considerate that some open areas, some additional parks, funding parks for folks who can't necessarily afford or find a space on a cul-de-sac street or with enough yard space to justify it, or, you know, adding, you know, altering, you know, considering paths between the houses, adding a sidewalk between houses to a nearby school or church or something.
So there are ways of bringing the benefits of the cul-de-sac lifestyle to people in the city and vice versa.
Absolutely.
Daniel, chime in here. The 99% Invisible episode we just heard a little bit of, they kind of came to the conclusion that cul-de-sacs are built for 5-year-olds. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true?
I think the idea that it's the sort of optimal place to raise children has been sort of a staple of marketing of residential development for a really long time. I think if you know you go back to the initial launch of a lot of these subdivisions, what you see in terms of moving there are largely families with children. I find it so ironic in that exchange that, you know, mother's sort of, you know, able to laugh about it. And, you know, her daughter's asking this, obviously, when she's become an adult. But I really doubt they would have had that conversation when she was younger. I don't think they would have seriously entertained the idea of being anywhere else. But now they are absolutely somewhere else. And why is it that they're somewhere else? It's because their children are grown.
Yeah.
And they don't sort of need that environment. So I think there's, you know, there's a sensibility, there's, you know, there's that lifestyle shift that happens largely because you get older, your children grow and that kind of thing. But that almost reinforces the notion that it's because the cul-de-sac is optimally for families with young kids.
Yeah, I'd like to chime in on that as well. I mean, nationwide, we all think of the suburbs as family focused, and they have, that's how they've been marketed. But that's not who actually lives there anymore. Since 2000, two-thirds of suburban households have not have kids in them. Nationwide, we're at 68% of households do not have kids in them. It's a lot of aging baby boomer empty nesters who are still there. And the privacy that they loved while raising their kids, now as some of them are starting, as more and more of them are starting to retire, it's starting to feel pretty isolated. And I think some of the issues that Kristen was raising, I mean, that's part of what we're seeing, a dramatic shift in the market preferences. And some folks do want to stay in that same community. They certainly want to stay in that community, most of them. Many want to stay in that same house, but they're looking for much more connectivity because once you don't have the school as your community anchor, once you don't have kids who are running around connecting you to the other households, we're seeing that older people on cul-de-sacs have far less connection.
And we're going to talk more about that connectivity piece of it in a little bit, but I want to hear from our callers. We've got a lot of people waiting to chime in here. So let's talk with Laura in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm great. I just wanted to call in and kind of give my perspective as a Gen Xer who's getting into middle age here. We've just decided to move out of the city and onto a cul-de-sac in North Kansas City. And really the biggest motivation for us in making this transition is that we just were not finding the right kind of housing stock in the city anymore. I have aging parents, and our home in the city with all the stairs was becoming really inaccessible to them. And so we started looking for more of a ranch style house, first floor bedrooms, first floor bathrooms. And you just cannot find that in the city. We would love to stay in the city, but we are really, truly, truly happy with the home that we've found in North Kansas City, and are really looking forward to moving and just having a place that's going to work not only for my parents, but also for us as we get older.
Laura, it would be interesting to hear from you down the road once you've made that move, just your insights into the differences when it comes to life on the cul-de-sac coming from the city. Would you be willing to tweet us or email us some updates as you go?
Absolutely. I also just wanted to chime in. You know, I mean, we were 30-year urbanites, and you know, we have a daughter who's now 15. I never would have thought of moving to the suburbs, and everybody thinks you need to move to the suburbs when you have kids. We never would have done it, and it's kind of ironic now that at this point in our life we've decided to do that.
That it works better for you as part of the aging process. That is really interesting. Let's talk now with Tommy. Tommy is in Peculiar. Hi, Tommy.
Hi there.
What can you share?
What I wanted to share was I'm a toilet pumper, you know, portable toilet pumper, and so I go to a lot of different areas. And my brother was a paramedic and was trying to take the test for the fire department to run a pumper truck as well. And you have to pass a test and get 95%. And one of the worst areas that I found and that he had to deal with was the suburb of Leawood, Kansas. And there is nothing that runs straight over there within that entire area. Nothing is linear. Everything is loops, twists, turns, cul-de-sacs. I finally had to give up doing any construction sites over there.
So that's really interesting. That sounds like an infrastructural challenge. I mean, even down to plumbing.
Oh, it is a nightmare. It's a nightmare just to try and get around. And he never could get 95 on the test for Leawood. And that's where he worked. Leawood is the only area that you don't have to live in order to be on the city staff or
wow.
The fire department or the police department or whatever. But houses, you know, used to start at half a mil and climb, you know, from there. And I think now they're close to 900 or a mil. But anyway, be that as it may, I just wanted to pass on that that's taking that concept to the extreme, and it's almost gridlock because you can't find anything.
Yeah.
And that was the problem that he had. Somebody calls in, they're having a heart attack. He has to be able, you know, to get there, you know, in the paramedic mobile, you know, or on, you know, one of the trucks. And I just wanted to pass that along, that that's an example of taking the French the cul-de-sac and taking nonlinear streets, no grid whatsoever, and none of the addresses make any sense. You can't tell one from another.
Thank you, Tommy. Very interesting point.
That's what I wanted to simply pass on. And particularly to city planners.
Thank you.
It's a nightmare.
Okay, so very clear how Tommy feels about cul-de-sacs with a really very specific safety angle. What about public transit? As more and more people take an interest in transit and express a desire to have a more robust transit system, is the prevalence of cul-de-sacs a barrier to giving certain communities better access?
Absolutely. You know, the issue with transit is that there's always the last, 10-minute walk. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, transit service is never going to come to your door. I mean, in any environment, you're always going to have to walk 10 minutes or so to get to transit. And the issue is if the underlying neighborhood fabric itself is not terribly walkable. I was thinking, as Kristen was talking earlier, the issue is not just that there aren't sidewalks that connect cul-de-sac areas to other areas. It's that often the cul-de-sacs themselves lack sidewalks. And so you have people mm-hmm. walking along the edge of the roadway and that sort of thing. That's a huge challenge that we have to address and think about.
KCUR's Central Standard has to take one last break. There's still just a little more time to get in on this discussion. Not much. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. We're talking about cul-de-sacs. It comes from the French language, meaning bottom of the bag. But in America, it's a prominent design feature, a kind of street that lots of people live on, particularly in the suburbs. It's become more contentious, and we're discussing that change in attitude. Our guests are Georgia Tech's Ellen Dunham Jones. She teaches in the School of Architecture there, and local design gurus Daniel Serta of Insight and Kristen Jeffers, who blogs as the Black Urbanist. I want to get back to some of our callers. Let's talk to Wendy in Gladstone. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, thanks for having me. We live on a cul-de-sac, and it's been a great place for our children to learn how to ride their bikes, and now they're both old enough to drive, and it was a great place to teach them how to drive. We do have a wonderful community. We get together monthly, mostly outdoors, weather permitting. We have drinks on deck. Kids come, adults come. Sometimes we have bands, and we've just kind of turned it into a really neat community venue on the cul-de-sac.
A little community there, it sounds like.
It is, and we do have a staircase going up to the elementary school, and there's a playground beyond that. And on the other end of the neighborhood, you can walk about 10 minutes to catch the city bus. So we're not isolated.
Yeah, there are a couple things I want to pick up on here. One is this learning to ride a bike issue. Actually, Central Standard did a show over the summer about news that fewer kids are riding bikes today than in the past. And one of our guests explains that cul-de-sacs could be part of the reason why. He said that because there are so many places where side streets don't go anywhere, bike traffic, like pedestrian traffic and car traffic, is forced onto really busy streets, which intimidates parents and kind of understandably so. Kristen, what can you say about this?
I definitely learned how on those cul-de-sacs to get my bearings. You know, I'm talking about moving from trike to first set of, you know, training wheels, and then the training wheels come off. I think that, and honestly, it's not just what I think. There's actually design principles now that allow for, you know, safer streets. You know, we talk about complete streets. Overseas, there's the Woodenough concept. And even here in America, you have the bike boulevards, you know, and then there's the Vision Zero campaign. All these things that talk about slowing everybody down, you know, not just on the residential streets, but just the concept that we're just moving at such a pace that we can't just stop to think about, you know, not only our children, but our elders. You know, the caller who said they were moving just so they could have more room and more space and less of an incline for their parents.
Yeah, on a ground level, yeah.
You know, being on the ground level. So there's a need in some places to be in housing stock. The thing is, can we merge that housing stock with a slower traffic environment with a more, you know, amenable biking and walking environment?
You know, some of our listeners, while we're thinking about this community aspect, because it sounds like Wendy has found a cul-de-sac where, you know, people have turned that into a gathering space for that pocket of families. And that's one experience that people have. When KCUR did a year-long project called Beyond Our Borders, we had listening sessions in different neighborhoods. And in the Northland, we actually heard the opposite from some people who were feeling like the cul-de-sacs kept little pockets isolated from one another. And as part of a growing desire to be more connected, they were talking about the possibility of cul-de-sac removal. I want to turn back to Ellen Dunham Jones. Ellen, what do you know about cul-de-sac removal? Is that actually a thing?
Well, it's sort of the holy grail of retrofitting the suburbs, which is the topic of most of my research. And honestly, I have to say, I mean, I've got about 1,300 examples of all different ways that different kinds of property types have been retrofitted into more sustainable places, but not yet a single example of cul-de-sacs that have been connected through streets. There are lots of examples where they bike connections, walk connections, but so far, it still gets resisted every time. Court cases. I mean, there are a lot of communities that have really been trying, but we're still sort of waiting to see. I think what's going to get really interesting is actually in the future, as we start to see driverless cars and more electric cars such that promise to both dramatically increase the safety and reduce the nuisance, the noise and the toxic and the emissions. You know, are we going to, so if the raison d'etre for the cul-de-sac initially was safety plus community, if driverless, if the projections that in 15 years, hardly any of us will own cars and it'll all be a big driverless Uber fleet kind of connecting us to transit and things, if that really does pan out, then it's the community aspects and the desire for connectivity that will allow us, I think, to really reimagine what our landscape looks like.
Yeah. Daniel Serta, what do you think about this idea of isolation versus connectivity in relation to cul-de-sacs?
Well, I think the reality is that, you know, cul-de-sacs are a challenging environment for that sense of connectivity. And it's this question of at what scale do you expect to have neighboring happen? And there are lots of great examples. I mean, nobody should feel guilty about living on a cul-de-sac. But, you know, typically when you have that more active life, it is literally the people that live along that particular cul-de-sac. If you have a very active homeowners association, you're part of a larger subdivision, there might be community facilities and other things nearby that, again, help promote that connectivity. The really big challenge out there that I think we're all contending with is the reality that the initial thinking, the Radburn-like thinking, the designers and architects who put together that stuff back in the 1920s, you know, the creative thought, not just about safety, not just about, you know, creating connections for automobiles, but providing for pedestrian environments, providing connectivity, providing separate pathways. There's a lot of detail. I would really encourage people to look in that in terms of how creative the thinking was in a place like Radburn. Developers lost that very quickly. They did not invest in those community amenities. And that's the real challenge, is that the lack of community amenities, nearby parks, pathways that connect to those parks.
Yeah.
That's what we're really having to contend with.
We're hearing from so many people who want to chime in and say that they've raised children on cul-de-sacs and that it's been a wonderful experience, one that they wouldn't trade for anything else. And we're hearing that input. We're hearing you. And we want to turn also to Mark in Brookside, who has another perspective to share, maybe one we haven't heard yet. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I had a professor in college who said that the definition of a peasant is someone who's never left their own neighborhood. And it doesn't matter how wealthy the neighborhood or how well appointed, if you can't see kind of outside of your own little world, there's a certain poverty there. And, you know, that's one of my concerns, that the way we build cities and communities and neighborhoods is that they're kind of walled off, self-contained. And I think psychologically and culturally, there's a certain kind of disconnect and poverty there that I happen to be a psychotherapist, and I frequently work with young people from the suburbs, and oftentimes that's the angst I hear in them, is just a sense of, like, I can't seem to get out of this place, you know. And wanting to see more of the world. And it's almost like, to me, a cul-de-sac is kind of a symbol of that consciousness.
I wonder, Daniel Serta, what you think of that.
I can entirely see that. Like I said, there's been obviously a certain degree of disaffection with these environments that has driven people to look for more active, more varied social life in particular, and environments that they want to live in that seem to reflect that. Again, I think the challenge is that in a lot of the places, an idea that had some real strengths to it and some real value, a lot of the fine details got lost in the shuffle of the mass building out of the suburbs. And there are just so many places that were built without those larger physical connections. You know, there's a lot of research that shows that the more walkable your neighborhood is, the more opportunities you have for informal encounters on the street.
But what
to
do
about benefits to that?
That so many people are saying they wouldn't trade this experience for the world. I'm hearing so much about the greater good, about the setup of our cities, sure. But that individual experience.
Well, like I said, the individual experience is valued. You make of what you do of it. And like I said, it's not to take away from anybody that's had a positive experience. It's just that for those who want to find that larger sense of connectedness, there's a real physical barrier in the way in these kinds of environments.
Our time is up for this conversation, nerding out on cul-de-sacs here on KCUR's Central Standard. Daniel Serta of Insight, a pleasure as always.
Thank you. Always see you too, Jane.
Kristen Jeffers, blogging as The Black Urbanist, and joining us from Bike Walk KC, love your perspective.
Oh, thank you.
And Ellen Dunham Jones, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us from Georgia Tech.
My pleasure.
This conversation will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, in case you had not heard. Central Standard will be taking a day off to bask in gratitude, but you can tune in for a holiday special during the 10 o'clock hour. And on Friday, we'll broadcast our live storytelling event from earlier this month. The theme was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, perfect for holiday travelers. That's Friday. Don't miss it. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date.
This is KCUR 89.3 and KCUR.org. What are you grateful for? It might be a more important question than you realize. Tomorrow on a special called The Science of Gratitude, we explore how feeling grateful may be the true key to health and happiness. It's going to start at 10 o'clock. Central Standard will return on Friday. Central Standard is supported by Kansas City Repertory Theater presenting the Santaland Diaries, David Sedaris' irreverent tale of his brief, misguided career as a Macy's elf, starring Brian Sills. That's December 3rd through the 24th. Tickets are online at kcrep.org. And St. Luke's Mid-America Heart Institute, recently recognized by the U.S. News & World Report for their cardiology and transplant services in Kansas City and across the nation. Details online at stlukeskc.org/heart. It's just about 11 o'clock, 55 degrees.